this is, we'll go back to Goshen a little bit. There was a real problem with Derry Lee, and there was a big investigation. The plant managers were taking reconstituted skim milk, which is a class 2 product, and standardizing the regular milk with that, which is a class 1 product, and which is illegal. You can't do it. And a lot of people lost their jobs then. A lot of the plant managers who were doing it, the office managers, and it wasn't just one plant. It was just about everything. And I think that goes back to having a board of directors being your manager. They just were looking at your performance, not how you were doing things. And so they were summoned to Albany by Ag and Markets in a big hearing. A lot of people lost their job. You know, they were taking pasteurizer operators and batch people to Albany to interview them and find out what was going on. After that, it was under the milk market administrator, and he was in the plant every week, and you had to account for every bag of non-fat dry milk that was used. And if you were missing some, oh my God, where'd it go? You'd have to prove, it went into a product it should go into. It didn't get reconstituted to standardized milk. Standardized milk is, milk comes in on a tanker. It's usually 3.6% fat to 3.8%. And so the minimum butter fat for the state was 3.4. So you'd reduce the butter fat by adding skim to the milk to bring it from 3.6 down to 3.4. And reverting back to my Goshen days, I got my production desk and I'm assistant plant manager figuring out all the production. I go through all these desks in there, and here's a chart on how much skim to add to the milk, how to reconstitute it, and how to put it back. Oh my God, I threw that away. I should have kept it for posterity, probably. But so now let's go back to Syracuse, and I'm the quality manager there. I have one plant. It's a tough plant. We got the cockroaches cleaned up, but by just bringing in another really good pest control operator, and they still use them to this day. I even use them for the cluster flies at my house now. They're just really good guys, and they understand the business, and were real professionals, and tracked down the cockroaches. They knew right where they were coming from and went after the nest. And you never saw another cockroach there afterwards. And so Derry Lee now is down to three plants: Syracuse, Oneida, and Vernon. Syracuse being the fluid milk plant making the school milk and the gallon jugs and all that. Oneida is the extended shelf life plant making half and half and creams and some fluid milk in this little product called Lactaid that the guy came in and nobody figured it, that would ever go anyplace because it tasted so sweet. And now that product is in every store in the U.S. and it's the workhorse for making money for H.P. Hood. So then it got to about 1988, and I was promoted to a quality manager for the three plants upstate. A nice job. I got my company car and three plants right in my dooryard, and I didn't have to travel anymore unless to go to a conference or something. So I enjoyed that for 4 or 5 years. And then Derry Lee decides they want to get out of the milk processing business. They just want to be a group of farmers who sells the raw milk to somebody else to process. So H.P. Hood came along and bought us in 1998. And we all thought that was a real positive move. And for everybody, here comes somebody who understands our business. They had an extended shelf life plant in Boston, a fluid milk plant in Boston. And so now comes the survival part again. Am I going to survive this? You know, they got people like me, and I knew them. And so there was some shaky days there as they were figuring out how to restructure the thing. But I survived that. I came out as a technical service manager, and I was responsible for the three plants out here. And they gave me Newington, Connecticut. It was an ESL plant that made ice cream mix for Burger King, McDonald's, and everybody, ourselves. And I really enjoyed that job for a long time. And then at that time, Agway had owned Hood, and Agway was on the way out. They were financially in trouble, and couldn't spend a lot of money on Hood. I was in a division at this point. They restructured again. I survived that. The other two technical service managers were gone. And so I ended up with the manufactured products group, which was Oneida, Vernon, and Newington, Connecticut, as the technical service manager. But that was also the profitable side of the business. The other plants, the fluid plants, the Boston plant, were all in financial trouble now. But us guys of the MPG group, we were like partying. We had a good customer group. We had that lactate milk, which everybody was making money on. One of the guys had an idea. We used to make that for lactate, and they would sell it and market it. Guys had an idea to license it. They would sell us the enzymes, and we would produce and sell the product. And unbelievable growth in that. And but you know, Hood was getting on hard financial times. They just didn't have any money. The management was not good. But our quality was still good. So, you know, we had that. So along came this guy, John Caneb, and his family. John was an oil man. He had owned Gulf Oil. And he had several sons in the business with him. And he had money. And he recognized what Hood was good at. He was always said, you guys never lost the quality, and I liked you about that. You know, the money part of it was just awful. And they needed to close the Boston plant, which was a huge milk plant. And it had been a money maker. They could print money out of that place at times, but there were sometimes it just lost terrible. They needed to close it. Nobody had nerve enough to make the decision to close it, because they knew it had made money at times. So John Caneb came in and closed the plant, closed Boston, moved that volume to Agawam, Massachusetts, and Portland, Maine. And so they were in tough shape. They were just struggling by. The fluid group, us MPG guys, we were just having fun and golf outings and all this stuff going on in the summer, and we were getting our bonuses. You know, we'd get up to, you know, 20% of your salary as a bonus, and we were maxing out on that. And the other guys over there, they were just dying. they were getting jealous and mad at us the way we did things. Yeah. So John Caneb came along and recognized what was there, and started to build a business, give us money to expand plants, expanded Oneida. Again, the lactate, it just drove that place. And then you'd have the creams and the creamers and low-fat milk for Burger King and McDonald's and that kind of stuff. So then they, that point, they made me an auditor, and I would go around to the, I think there were 7 or 8 plants left at that time, and I would audit them for compliance to good manufacturing practices and regulations and that kind of stuff. And I enjoyed that. I was away, different place every week, just myself to worry about. I didn't have to worry about any of my other employees to, because that's a worry, they screw up, you got to answer for it. And so I did that for a few years. Didn't really have a boss for a while. My boss had retired, and they hadn't hired anybody, so it even made it better. And so they hired a woman, Peggy Poole, to be my boss. And I was the auditor for a while longer, and then she made me director of quality from auditing manager. So I had 7 plants: Portland, Maine, Barrie, Vermont, Agawam, Massachusetts, Suffield, Connecticut, Oneida, Vernon, Syracuse. Well, Syracuse was gone at that point, but it's still a consolidating industry. And you know, not only were plants closing because of efficiencies, dairy companies were buying them and by taking over milk companies and integrating that production in with their own to make them more efficient. So I had that job for a while. The quality managers, I had a manager in each plant. They reported to me. And once again, there'd be a hot spot every week. Something would go wrong someplace, and that's where I'd head out to and support the manager. And again, it just one, my management style was to make, I'd just be the facilitator and make sure they had everything they needed. I had to go straighten out a couple messes where the lab technicians would, in one plant, had taken over the plant, I called it, taken over the lab. They were doing things the way they wanted, and they weren't listening to the quality manager, so I had to go up and clean house with them, figure out who wanted to do a good job and who was just causing trouble. So I had to do that. I said, look, we got it straight now. Just don't ever let it get this bad again. And I helped the quality manager there. She's still a quality manager and doing a good job. So then came along lactate again. We need to make more lactate. So that drove building a plant in Winchester, Virginia. And at that point, they asked me to go down there and supervise that we had to build a lab. We had to build a quality control department. We had to hire a quality manager. We had to make sure the plant complied with regulations. The design was right and everything. We had to get the design approved by regulatory. So I went down and did all that. We got the plant open in 2000 after a year of production, flying all over the country, buying looking at equipment to buy the right stuff. We were in the business, so we knew how to run things, but we wanted to buy the very best. And so we got that up and running. I was in Winchester every week for 18 months at that time. Go down Monday morning, come back Friday night. Just a killer, it really tires you out like that. And so got them up and running in capacity. They just can't make enough product. They were doing lactate and then Nestle Quick, little plastic bottles of Nestle Quick for Nestle. Again, it was a licensed deal. We would buy the chocolate powder from them at the upcharge. That's how they would make money. And then we would directly sell it to the stores and then we would make money. And so they expanded again. They had started up with 2 fillers. Now it's 4 fillers, and just state-of-the-art plant. People from Washington, the FDA, would come over and see how we were doing stuff. We got very close with them, worked with the FDA a lot. And then one of the last things they did there was Nestle decided they wanted to expand into the aseptic product line. Aseptic is you sterilize the product, you sterilize the package, you put the product in the package in a sterile environment, and then seal it with a sterile cap. It can stay at room temperature almost forever. There's just no bacteria in there, nothing to spoil it. Unless something went wrong in the package, and that's another story. But so that was a neat project that I worked on, and we did a lot of stuff that nobody else had ever done. Nobody else had put it in a plastic bottle aseptically. They'd done it for years, and we did it in the brick pack. And you sterilize the package material with hydrogen peroxide. And so that was a fun year. We were trying to decide, since nobody had ever done it, which of the equipment manufacturers had the best chance of doing it. And so, flew to Germany to look at the design they had. They weren't there yet. They didn't have a lot of answers for us. And then we went to Italy, same thing. And yeah, we're going to be ready next year. You can depend on us. And nobody really there yet. So then we heard about this outfit, Shibuya, in Japan. So we flew to Japan. And these guys are doing it over there. We went up to a Coca-Cola plant to look at them doing a huge machine, very complex. But we're struck by, who's running this? There's nobody out there running it. It's like, it's running flawless. There's like nothing going wrong. We're, the way we do things, everything, you have a crash and everything would blow up. And went down to their factory and they were doing everything we wanted to do. But that was under Japanese regulations. Nobody on this side of the ocean was doing it. So we hired what they call a process authority. They have, to be aseptic, you have to have a process authority to you to validate your equipment and validate your process that, yes, it can do what you're saying it does. And so we had to work with a different group of FDA guys, the low-acid canned food, because milk a low-acid product. Low-acid products, all bacteria grows in. You can make botulism, and you can have all sorts of trouble there. So you're very, very careful on your process and documenting that everything was right through the process. And so we contracted with Shibuya to buy that machine. Machine was came in on 17 tractor trailer loads, and they assembled this thing. They flew their Japanese workers over, and they were going to spend 40 or 50 of them there. They get a Chinese restaurant to put up a tent and serve their food outside because they wanted Chinese food. That, if, like when we were over there, we didn't want Japanese food, and we wanted good old American stuff. So they did that. It took a year to build that, and now we got to get it validated. And so I was responsible for working with the process authority and our production people to validate the machine. I don't know how much of this technical stuff you want to go in, but basically, we started out with a bottle. we would blast hydrogen peroxide in it, and it was in a sterile environment. That environment had been sterilized by spraying hydrogen peroxide in it. Not like the kind you find in a bottle, which is 1 or 2%. We would use 35%, and you had to, if you said 35%, if it was 34%, you weren't sterile. You had to start over again, make it 35 or higher. And then we would put milk in a bottle. We'd sterilize the caps upstairs someplace and put them together all at 600 a minute. Like nobody had ever gone that fast before, because milk is a foamy product. And if you go too fast, you build foam up and you're in a mess. You can't get it out. So they had the right filler configuration so you could go that fast. And so we did it. We got it approved. We did the validation. First one in the country to do that. I got invites to speak at conferences I'm not going to tell them how we did it, but to let them know our process, and here we are, we got this, and the product's out today. Nestle got us into that, and then they decided to build their own plant out in the middle of the country someplace. And if you go down to Price Chopper now, you look in the drink aisle, you'll see Muscle Milk. That's made on that equipment. And the idea behind it was, why we got into it, was Nestle wanted to put milk in vending machines. And so vending machines, whether you know it or not, have a very small refrigerated area. The bulk of the inventory is at room temperature. And so you got to be aseptic until they want to drink it. Somebody wants to drink it cold, so it just, the bottle goes down and finally it's in a refrigerated area. That's about where I, retired from Hood. Had a good time. Met a lot of people around the country. I was representing Hood with the regulatory people, the FDA people, and going to conferences and, getting approvals, getting us out of trouble. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. And it usually went wrong on a Friday afternoon. And our theory was that people didn't want to carry that. They wanted to cleanse their conscience before they went into the weekend, and all the stories would start coming out so they could feel good when they went home. I didn't have to take that burden home with them. But it was funny, and Friday afternoon was a nightmare. So, anything else?
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the dairy industry and the government?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I first got in the business back in the 70s, all these local regulatory outfits were regulating the industry. You'd have East Orange, New Jersey bring up their inspector. You'd have Pennsylvania send their inspector. You'd have New Jersey send their inspector. New York City send their inspector. And so they tried to consolidate that. So you just have one guy you got to worry about. And they did that through the pasteurized milk ordinance, which was a group of regulatory people and a group of industry people. Industry, the producers were the guys that represented the farmer, call that producer. Processing side was the other side. So there's three entities there that they're doing this. All of the states would send a representative to the conference. The conferences were every other year. And the first one, I'm not sure the date of that, that was a little blue book, and they called that the Bible. And that was the pasteurized milk ordinance. So it would evolve as technology evolved. And regulatory processing, and the producers would go to the conference and consider proposals to change the rules of the pasteurized milk ordinance, PMO. And they would usually send a paperwork out, you know, 6 months ahead of time. And people who thought something ought to be changed or didn't make sense or needed to be worded differently or something needed to be changed to allow for new technologies. And it was fun. I participated in it directly. There were three councils who would be given the proposals to consider. Some of them you could not support. It's an industry, but regulatory would want that support. You know, industries was always less regulation, it's better for us, and industry is, no, they got to have more regulation, or regulatory wanted more regulation, of course. You know, they're protecting their jobs and all that kind of stuff. We wanted less. But we usually hammered it out to what people could live with. And the councils would receive the proposals based on, I can't remember now which council was which, based on their expertise. And there was also committees, a technical committee and a sampling committee, and those are just a couple, who would get the proposals and make a recommendation to the council. The council usually went along with the committee's recommendation. The committee was made up, you know, a third producer, a third regulatory, and a third processing, as the councils were. I was on a couple of the councils over the years. And the councils would make a recommendation to the delegates. The delegates were all regulatory people from each state. And they would have the ultimate vote. And they would vote, and the board of the executive board would send them to the FDA, the milk control branch, who had all been there. They were all on the councils or sat in on them, with a recommendation that these be proposed or, you know, changed or accepted or not accepted, thrown out. Some of them were really nutty stuff that guys that didn't really understand what they were doing would write them, and usually the same guys. and it would get pretty funny sometimes. Oh, here comes this one. Then they would go in effect, and they'd rewrite the PMO and change everything. And two, back when the PMO first started in the 70s, all of the states signed off as reciprocity. If I'm in New York, Pennsylvania would accept the New York inspector's work if milk from New York went into Pennsylvania. And likewise, the other way around. There were a couple holdouts. Connecticut was one, and they held out for a long time. They wanted to come inspect the plant for themselves and then come into New York and do that. And New York, oh, if you're going to come inspect our plants, we're going to go inspect your plants. And, you know, that kind of stuff went on. And they weren't laws. The PMO isn't laws. The CFR, Code of Federal Regulations, is laws. And so, but everybody had signed on saying that, yeah, we will abide by these. And so now you have to have a rating. You have a local inspector who does the day-to-day work, the 90-day inspections. Your pasteurizers have to be tested every 90 days to make sure they're pasteurizing the milk correctly. And the people know what they're doing, and the records look good. And then they would come do an inspection. And you had to do that, or they put you on a 30-day re-inspect. And and then they would take samples of your milk, send it to, if it was a New York plant, go to a New York lab.